Welcome to the sixth and final session of Panorama Plus 3, Redemption and Wandering. This is not the easiest of biblical terrain. You're to be congratulated on completing the journey. Now, remember this. The covenant people, that is to say the Israelites, are poised on the eastern side of the Jordan River. They are poised and ready to cross the Jordan into the land that had been promised to them by Abrahamic covenant stipulations. The previous generation had died in the near 40 years of wandering in the wilderness after the Kadesh Barnea incident. Moses will not be permitted to enter the land, but he has one huge task to perform before he will die and pass the baton to Joshua, the next leader. And that huge task is to instruct the new generation. These were the ones who were children when their fathers rebelled, and they have to be instructed in the law. So Moses must instruct that generation and preside over a very important covenant renewal. Remember, the word covenant in biblical terminology means contract. When God enters into covenant with people, He's entering into a binding agreement or a contract in our language today. He must commission this new leader, and we need to understand this, that success and blessing in the future land, is going to be predicated upon what Moses will teach and the instructions that Moses will give. And so with that as our introduction, let's begin by looking at page 155 in our workbook. And you'll notice on the very first page we have a chart of all 12 movements and the primary biblical books that are associated with those movements. We have completed Panorama Plus 1 and Plus 2. Those are available by video on the Build Training Center website. We are now completing today Panorama Plus 3. You'll notice the biblical books we have looked at, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and today, Deuteronomy. If you turn the page, you'll notice our familiar timeline at the top of the page. We have those key people, places, events, and dates for the redemption at the top. The redemption timeline also speaks of the Exodus event, the Sinai event, and the Tabernacle event. Those were our first three sessions of this Panorama Plus 3. We are in the wandering section. The book of Numbers has taken us from preparation, departure, rebellion into the wandering, and we're in the last month or so of that 40 years, roughly 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, leading us to the plains of Moab. That's the eastern side of the Jordan River, where from there they will launch in the next biblical book, the book of Joshua, they'll launch into the promised land. We have also that chart on the Pentateuch. We are in the last column, the book of Deuteronomy, a key word, instruction, or maybe even re-instruction would be a better way of saying it. We are going to have the Deuteronomic code introduced to us right in the middle of the book, and then we'll also have that re-instruction as a part of that. On the top of page 157, a familiar chart from Dr. Salehammer, those five boxes representing in the Pentateuch, we consider that one book with five parts, but within the Pentateuch, those boxes represent narrative literature, whereas the larger box that has the word laws represents legal literature. Deuteronomy is considered by Dr. Salehammer to be narrative, but it's a little bit narrative and it's a little bit legal literature as well. It's kind of a hybrid, as we will see as we go through the book. Now, let's just really, in awe, look at the chart on the bottom of page 157. Here's our Deuteronomy overview. And you'll notice if you're trying to capture and get your arms around the book of Deuteronomy, the four columns, there's four addresses. Deuteronomy is really not technically a restatement of the law, the second law. It's really four sermons on the law. And Moses is going to discourse or preach practical sermons on how to apply the law. And we represent that in our chart. You'll notice address number one, beneath the column at the bottom, that's a historical review. We'll back up and go over turf we've already been over. Then there's some legal requirements in chapters 4 to 26, including a look again, a restatement of the 10 laws or the Ten Words, or the Ten Commandments, and then also what will be known as the Deuteronomic Code. We'll get there. There's an unusual element to the Deuteronomic Code, and I'll lean into Dr. Eugene Merrill for that. We'll see it when we come to it. Address 3, there's some additional blessings and cursings. It's really future responsibilities. Once you enter into the land, here are some things you must remember, and Moses will preach a good sermon or two on that, along with the leadership transition. As we turn the page to page 158, Dr. Norm Geisler always summarizes Old Testament books with historical, doctrinal, and Christological purpose. You can read that. It's pretty straightforward. I want us to look at the distinctive features at the bottom of page 158. Before we launch into Deuteronomy, let's get a flavor of something that's unique about the book. And the first thing I want you to notice is Deuteronomy is quoted or alluded to close to 100 times in the New Testament. That's a lot. In other words, along with Genesis, Psalms, and Isaiah, it is one of the 4 most quoted Old Testament books when we get into the New Testament. That means that it holds a high place, not only of honor, but of importance in understanding New Testament truth. Jesus will quote it quite freely in His ministry as well. Point 2, also in Deuteronomy, we have the second statement or restatement of the Ten Commandments with a few differences, and we'll take a peek at those differences. Number 3, Deuteronomy, surprisingly, is really heavily on obedience to God's clear commands. But Deuteronomy also has a lot to say about the love of God. We tend to think of command and love as being distinct and far apart. Not so in the biblical thinking. In biblical thinking, a law, a command, is out of love. We understand that as parents. We give parental laws because we're trying to protect our children. And we sometimes think that laws are restrictive when really they're there to bring freedom. Freedom to express or freedom to live life to the fullest. And we'll see that. God's love for His people expressed even in His laws that He gives to His people. Dr. Samuel Schultz, an Old Testament scholar, says, it's the most important book in the Old Testament in relation to, or from the standpoint of God's relationship to man. You see that coming out, the relational aspect of God's dealings with His chosen nation, and that relational love aspect really comes out in Deuteronomy in a remarkable way. excuse me, top of the next page. So be careful not to forget. Or sometimes you'll see it, only be careful is a frequent warning and theme. Be careful, be careful, be careful. Be careful, little hands. Be careful, little eyes. We use that kind of terminology with our children and our grandchildren. Well, that is something that Moses will bring out, a phrase that he will use quite often in the book. You'll notice the chart where we have a comparison between the first 4 books of the Pentateuch compared to just Deuteronomy standing alone. Genesis to Numbers, it's the development of Israel's history. But in Deuteronomy, it's the philosophy of the history. In other words, we get a lot of the whys behind some of the laws and stipulations and regulations. In Genesis through Numbers, it's divine performances, what God is doing. In Deuteronomy, there are divine principles, as Moses, as a good preacher, is going to give some good principles for life. We're going to see a few of them and make note of some today. In Genesis to Numbers, primarily God speaks to Moses. In Deuteronomy, Moses is preaching. He has 4 addresses, and so we have Moses speaking to the people. We'll not take time to go over the chart at the bottom of the page, but it is a remarkable thing that in ancient times, there was a Hittite treaty. They were called suzerainty treaties. And what we find is the book of Deuteronomy follows an ancient pattern that other cultures used as well, particularly the Hittites. And I've just given you the correlation there. That's just for completeness, but we're not going to cover it in our teaching. We want to get right into the biblical development on the next page. So if you will turn to page 160 at the top, point A, address number 1. Here's our first sermon, and this sermon is somewhat of our historical review. So we're going to, remember, we are located on the east side of the Jordan River, but now we've got to flash back and remember what has been taught us from Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. And so we've got to have a little bit of a historical flashback. Look at point A there, the previous command to leave Mount Horeb. And we've already indicated we are on the east side of the Jordan River. We are near the end of the 40 years of wandering. Three, what is happening? Moses is beginning to preach or expound or explain the law. Excuse me. There are less prohibitions in the book of Deuteronomy and a lot more instruction on how to live successfully before God. And so if you'll look at Deuteronomy 1:8 at the bottom, here's what happens. See, I have given you the new generation that's about to enter the land. See, I have given you this land. This is God speaking. Go in and take possession. Go in, enter, take possession, conquer the land that God swore He would give to you so that you could possess it. Enter, conquer, possess. By the way, that's the broad outline of the book of Joshua. We see that in movement number 4, the conquest. You enter the land, to conquer the land, and you possess the land. We already have it foreshadowed for us here in Deuteronomy 1:8. Then there's a little bit of a flashback on the appointment of leadership. Moses is, well, let's just go ahead and say it. He's whining just a little bit about the responsibility of this large mass of people. And at the top of page 161, Moses is speaking and he says, oh, how can I bear the problems and the burdens of all these people by myself? That is the great leadership question. How do I, as a leader, accomplish the vast amount of responsibility that is placed upon me, whatever that leadership might be? And the answer to the great leadership question is verse 13. Choose some wise, understanding, and respected men. In other words, the great leadership solution is build a team. You know, I think that would work in the corporate world. Rarely, but it could work. I think it's incumbent of necessity for ministries that a pastor or a spiritual leader cannot do it all, that you build a ministry team. That's why we see in the New Testament the plurality of elders, and you see a lot of we working together, Paul, Barnabas, and Silas going off on a trip together and things like that. We together are smarter and more capable than I alone. And I think that's probably true even in the corporate world, but it's certainly true in the ministry world. So, qualified leadership was needed. Deuteronomy 1:15-17, he says, so I took some leading men, some qualified men, to have authority over you. And here are the three qualifications of these judges over the people of Israel. It's down at the end of verse 16. They have to have the ability to judge fairly. Do you see that? In verse 16, judge fairly. Verse 17, they cannot show partiality. And then in also at the end of verse 17, and they can't be afraid of anyone. If you're going to exercise a leadership responsibility and judge disputes and mediate disputes and do all the other tasks of leadership, you have to be fair, don't show partiality, treat everybody the same, and don't be afraid of anybody. Don't be afraid of the high and mighty. Don't be afraid of the low and humble. I mean, just you do everything fairly without partiality and don't be afraid of anyone. Proverbs 24:23 just echoes this. Listen to it. These are the sayings of the wise. Hear this. To show partiality in judging is not good. And so that those are a little bit of the building of that team. These are the kind of people we need. Then at the bottom of the page, the spies who are to be sent out, chapter 1, verse 19 to 25, we have the, after this aside on selecting leaders, we have the Kadesh Barnea incident, which is always placed alongside that golden calf failure. These are the two great failures of the new nation that was constituted as God's nation at Mount Sinai. They had been redeemed from the Egyptian bondage, constituted as a nation at Mount Sinai, given their marching orders, and yet the golden calf and Kadesh Barnea, the 12 spies going in, and they don't listen to the 12 spies, or the minority report of the two spies. This is the great failure. Moses is speaking at the bottom of page 161, Deuteronomy 1:22. This is also recorded in Numbers 13. He said, "Then all of you came to me and said, let's send men ahead to spy out the land for us and tell us about the route to take. And the idea seemed good to me," verse 23. So I selected 12 men. There's a little bit of a biblical problem. If you read Numbers 13, it says the Lord commanded them to send spies in. So, the Bible has made a mistake. Or we need to think a little more deeply about what the actual sequencing of events might have been. Let me suggest to you that all biblical writers write from a certain perspective in time. And so the possible or probable order of what actually happened was that Moses called on the people to go in and take the land. We see that in Deuteronomy 1:20. The people hesitated and asked, well, can we first send spies in? That's Deuteronomy 1:22. Moses agrees. It sounds like a good idea to him in 1:23. Then there's no textual evidence for this, but I think probably what Moses did is he presented this plan to the Lord in prayer. In other words, we're making some human decisions, but let me ask the man, the ultimate authority here. And so I think Moses probably presented this plan to the Lord. The Lord agreed and then commanded Moses to select the 12 spies. And so we can harmonize two what appear to be contradictory passages. Really, if we see them in a harmonized sort of way, we see probably actually what would have happened in that case. As we turn the page, at the top of the page, we get to the, again, in our historical review, we're looking at the rebellion at Kadesh Barnea. The sending of spies was not God's, and we need to insert a word here, a word is left out. It was not God's initial command. We've already gone through the sequencing of events of how that probably happened. Deuteronomy 1:26, "You were unwilling to go up and take the land. You rebelled against the command of the Lord your God." Now notice verse 27. Not only did you rebel, you grumbled. Boy, did they ever. Remember, we had at least 10 occurrences or more of murmuring and grumbling and so forth. The people, this is what they were crying out, "The people are stronger and taller than we are. The cities are large. In fact, their walls reach up to the sky." Now that's a bit of an exaggeration. But exaggeration based on fear, not based on faith. Their walls go up to the sky. We even saw the Anakites there. That's the ancient clan of giants spoken of in Numbers 13. And so Moses pleaded with the people and he said, just remember. Remember God is the one who delivered us out of Egypt. Do you remember that? At this point, stop and let's rivet a principle deep within our souls as well. Because all of these things are written for our benefit. Here's the principle that we have to grasp. God's past faithfulness is the assurance of God's present faithfulness. Is that true? God's past faithfulness. If God has been faithful in the past, He's going to be faithful in the present. He'll be faithful in the future. And there's a great principle that Moses is pleading to is remember what God has done for us. He fought for us in Egypt. He will fight for us in Canaan. Deuteronomy 1:32, "In spite of this, you did not trust in the Lord your God." Rebellion and lack of faith in God's protection and provision must bring God's judgment response upon them. And the judgment response was, that generation is denied entrance into the promised land. Moses even and Aaron will be caught up in that, though for different specific reasons. But that generation will not be able to enter into the promised land. And God says, and now if you suddenly change your mind and try to go into the promised land and attack the Canaanites, I'm not going with you. And if you don't have me, you're probably not going to have success. And as we turn to the next page, top of 163, Deuteronomy 1:43, "So I told you not to go up and fight, but you wouldn't listen. You rebelled. In your arrogance and presumption, you went up and the Amorites whipped you good." And so we saw two failures of that first generation. First, they had a lack of faith and fear to go up and take the land immediately. And then secondly, they arrogantly and presumptively went up when they were told not to. This is a people who have not learned to trust and obey. And so consequently, they are denied entrance later into the promised land. again, telling our history as we leave Kadesh Barnea. We have a couple of battles. We do defeat Sihon. We also defeat Og. Deuteronomy 2 tells us that 38 years passed, a little over 38 years passed, from the time we left Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the Zered Valley. By then, that entire generation of fighting men had what? Perished. In other words, by God's judgment, that generation will not enter the land. And how does God ensure that that generation doesn't enter in the land? He allows them or requires them to wander in the wilderness until the generation of fighting men who did not believe and have faith until they perish. So, as we move on in the historical summary, we might recall that there were 2.5 tribes, Gad, Reuben, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, who wanted to settle on the eastern side of the Jordan River. But we have to cross to the western side to take the land for the other tribes. And so Moses says, that's fine. You can have the eastern side. But when you cross the river, you've got to, your fighting men have to go in with us and help defeat the Canaanites. And they all agree to that. And that's what we see at the bottom of 163 all the way to the top of 164. It's also at this time that Joshua will assume the reins of leadership from Moses. And on 164, we have three bullet points. Moses will command Joshua. Moses then will plead again with the Lord. And then the Lord will, in anger, answer Moses. In other words, there are some prayers that you can pray that will make God furiously mad at you, or at least in the experience of Moses. We'll see that in a moment. First, Moses commands Joshua. Deuteronomy 3:21. At that time I commanded Joshua. Skip down to verse 22. Do not be afraid of the Canaanites in the land. The Lord Himself will fight for you. Now, Moses is telling Joshua that, but that's also for the benefit of this second generation as well. We're not entering the land in a spirit of fear. We're entering the land in a spirit of trusting and obeying, and God will give us the victory. So, then the second bullet point, Moses is continuing to plead and ask God for something. At that time, I pleaded with the Lord. That's a pitiful word. I pleaded. Sovereign Lord, you've begun to show your servant your greatness, your strong hand. I mean, there's no God like you. I mean, he's really buttering up the Lord on that. Verse 25, so let me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, that fine hill country in Lebanon. That's Moses' request. Let me enter the land. Now, you'll recall Moses, his lack of faith, striking the rock twice and so forth, he was denied entering the land. God's already said, you're not going in. Now he's pleading again and again and again. Please let me go in. Please let me go in. Please let me go in. He's sort of like a child who thinks they can wear down their parent. And so he's pleading with it. And the answer at the bottom of page 164, verse 26, but because of you, rebellious generation, the Lord was angry with me. That's a Hebrew intensive in the biblical language. It better be best would be translated furious. The Lord was furious with me and would not listen to me. And this is what God said. That's enough. I think I've heard myself say that. That's enough. Do not speak to me anymore. In other words, that implies that Moses has been repeating this request and praying and pleading and repeating and praying and pleading. Do not speak any more about this matter. You go up to the top of Pisgah, which was a mountain peak in that whole range on the plains of Moab, up there in that area, and you can look all around you when you're up there, and you'll see with your own eyes, but you will not physically cross the Jordan River. What is Moses to do? It's not in your notes, but let me just read for you verse 28. Here's what he is to do. We know what he can't do, but here's what he is to do. But you commission Joshua, and you encourage and strengthen him. For he, Joshua, will lead this people across and cause them to inherit the land that you will see. Moses, your lack of faith also caused you to not be able to enter the land. So is there a good New Testament principle for this? Maybe it's this. When God speaks, we listen and we obey. No ifs, no ands, no buts. We need to be careful how we live our lives before Him. Now, in chapter 4, again in our historical overview, we highlight a few lessons. And these are nice lessons for us as well. The first lesson in the middle of 165 is of three is the lesson of obedience. Deuteronomy 4, 1 and 2. Now Israel, hear the decrees and laws that I'm going to give you. Skip down to the end of verse 2. Keep the commands of the Lord your God that I give you. Next verse, Deuteronomy 4, 6. Observe them carefully. They're going to give you wisdom and understanding. These laws lead to wisdom and understanding. We recall Psalm 110 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. These laws will give you wisdom and understanding. It'll make you a wise and understanding people. So you need to have the Word of God in your mind. Skip down to Deuteronomy 4, 9. Only, here it is again, be careful. Watch yourself carefully, closely. Don't forget these commandments. In fact, teach them to your children and to your children after them. Pass on a spiritual heritage. Let me summarize the lesson of obedience. Know the Word. Obey the Word. Watch yourself. Pass on your spiritual legacy. Turn the page. Second lesson of three. The lesson against idolatry. Deuteronomy 4:15. Look at the end of verse 15. Watch yourself very carefully so that, what? You don't make an idol. Now notice, an idol of like a man or a woman. Don't make an idol, verse 17, like an animal or a bird. Or in verse 18, like any creature or a fish. These were the ancient Near Eastern idols of that day. These were common idols that were worshipped by the peoples around the Israelites. And the Israelites are being told, you are so unique and different, you worship the only true God. All of those gods are false gods. They are non-gods. They're just simply idols that cannot speak, cannot predict, and cannot provide. They're just simply false. That's false worship. So, in light of Exodus 24 in the Ten Commandments, you shall not make for yourself an idol. It's restated here in Deuteronomy 4. Do not make idols. Middle of the page, the passage, Deuteronomy 4, 23. Be careful not to forget. Remember, that's a key phrase in the book of Deuteronomy. Be careful not to forget the covenant, the agreement, the contract. Do not make for yourselves an idol. Does anybody get it yet? Okay, let's stop for a moment. Let's go to the New Testament. Remember the gospel writer John? He also wrote three letters. The first letter has five chapters. And at the end of the five chapters, he has a one-verse conclusion to his letter. And it very simply reads in 1 John 5, verse 21, little children or of faith, little children of faith, keep yourself or guard yourself from idols. So what's an idol for us? Is it an image of a man or a woman or an animal or a bird or a creature or a fish? No. Listen carefully. An idol is anything, anyone, any pursuit, any passion, any ambition, anything that takes God's rightful place in your life. An idol could be a good thing worshipped in a wrong way. An idol is anything that takes God's rightful place in your life. That's why the hymn writer would say this, the dearest idol that I have known, whatever that idol be, help me tear it from thy throne and worship only thee. There's danger in substituting worship for things as opposed to God, the only one deserving of our full worship. So, watch out for those idols. Jump to the next page, 167. Here's our third lesson. It's just a basic lesson about God. Deuteronomy 4:35. You were shown these things. We would want to ask, what things? Well, previously it says, was speaking about God speaking through the fire and the smoke and the miraculous signs and miracles He performed and the victories He gave in battle. You were shown these things, God working on your behalf, supernaturally working on your behalf. You were shown these things. Why? So that you might know, not intellectually, but experientially, so that you might fully know that the Lord is God. That He really is who He says He is. That He really does exist. That He really does care. That He really has entered into relationship with us. That He really does expect certain things of us. And so there's a great lesson about God. All of these things happen that we might be able to fundamentally exalt Him and Him alone as the centerpiece of life, which is so incredibly difficult because we live in a culture where everything is snapping its fingers trying to get us to pay attention. And we're living in a culture that's a bit unraveling from its basic roots. And so in the box, in the middle of page 167, I quote one of my favorite verses, Deuteronomy 4:39. But here it is in the Amplified. I memorized it in King James. That's how long I've known that verse. But here it is in the Amplified. Know, recognize, and understand this day and turn your mind and heart to it, that the Lord is God in heaven above and upon the earth beneath. There's no other. And since there's no other, then let's make sure that in all that we do, that we obey His statutes and commands. Let's make sure we don't substitute anything for Him, an idol of our own making. And let's learn the great lesson about God, that we can enter into a close knowing of Him, not intellectually knowing, but actually experiencing Him. And so consequently, Deuteronomy 4:39, really basically what it's saying is God is sovereign over all. So obey His commandments. That comes in verse 40. Here's the second address. Now we have another sermon. We're through with a historical review. Now some legal requirements. And what we're going to see now is, whereas the book of Leviticus focused on laws for the priesthood, the book of Deuteronomy is going to focus on laws for daily life. How a redeemed people, a new generation, entering into the land promised to their forefathers, how are they supposed to live in this new land in order to be a distinctive nation set apart from all the other nations? And so the first seven chapters, Deuteronomy 5 through 11, will give some general things to know. It's good preaching, good general things. So we're going to look at his preaching points. And the first thing he does is at the top of page 168. And lo and behold, in Deuteronomy, Moses is going to give us the Ten Commandments once again. Only there's a little bit of difference. We've listed them for you. Also, whether or not that commandment has primarily a vertical or a horizontal focus. Is it an obligation to God or an obligation to my fellow man? But look at the fourth one. Observe the Sabbath. Remember that command? The Sabbath is extended to the whole household, include servants and everyone. But then it's added that it may go well with you. That's something new that we've not seen. Also, the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother, that it may go well with you. So we have a little bit of tweaking. The Sabbath, in view of God's redeeming us from out of our bondage to Egypt, and then honoring our father and mother. Otherwise, they're still pretty much the same. At the end of the giving of the Ten Commandments, it's not in your workbook, but the Lord speaks in Deuteronomy 5:29, and I'm just going to read it for you. Oh, that their hearts... Now, remember, this is God speaking. This is the heart of God. Oh, that their hearts, this new generation, oh, that their hearts would be inclined to fear me and to keep all of my commands so that it might go well with them and their children forever. The heart of God, if they would just obey my basic spiritual and moral laws, it would go well for them. It would go well for the generations after them. What of a generation that spurns the law of God and doesn't teach it to their children, who then reject it, and it's rejected the next generation? What do you get? You get the 21st century. Because that's where we are. We are distancing ourselves from the basic moral framework, or what we could call the Judeo-Christian ethic. And that's what's happening in our culture today. Beneath that chart of the Ten Commandments, we see Deuteronomy 5:32. So be careful. Are you catching this? Be careful. Watch yourself. Be careful to do what the Lord has commanded you. Verse 33, walk in obedience. That means live your life. Order your life in obedience so that all that the Lord has commanded you, so that you may live and prosper and prolong your days. In other words, obedience to God's moral law leads to blessing, and disobedience to God's law leads to cursing or discipline. And so that's a complete sermon. Chapter 6, there's an exhortation on loving God. He actually just takes the first commandment of no other gods before me, and he just expands it out a little bit. And at the bottom of page 168, you need to double star Deuteronomy 6, 4, and 5. This is what the Jewish people, even to this day, call the Shema or Shema. It's the word hear in Hebrew. And here it is. Here's the Shema. And this is a rallying cry for the Jewish nation today. This is for religious Jews today. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. That's their rallying cry. The Lord our God is one. So love Him with everything, every fiber within your being. Does that sound familiar? Well, look at the box on page 169. A teacher of the law came to Jesus and said, Jesus, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus replied, by doing what? Quoting the Shema. The Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, strength, all that. Verse 31, the second is like it, and that's found in Leviticus 19. Love your neighbor as yourself. Someone could say, well, who's my neighbor? So then we tell the story of the Good Samaritan, which basically says, you see somebody in need, take care of it. That's how you love your neighbor. You take care of them. You provide what's needed. Beneath that box, Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 9, these commandments I give you today, they're to be on your hearts. These are heart commandments, not just cold regulations. These are heart commandments. So impress them on your children and talk about them when you sit at home or walk down the road or whatever. Tie them, verse 8, as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. If you've been to Israel, you've seen the Hasidic Jews. And the Hasidic Jews, often there's a strap around their head, and on their forehead there's this little leather box looking thing. They'll also have wrapped around their arm another leather strap with a little box with it, and within that is a little portion of the Torah, because they're taking this very literally. As a matter of fact, if you turn the page, Jesus made comment about this very public display of the literal nature of that law in Deuteronomy. Jesus talking about the Pharisees, who were strict observers of the law and their traditions they built around the law. Jesus said, everything they do is done for people to see. They make their phylacteries, that's what they call these, phylacteries, wide, and the tassels on their garments long. Why? To be noticed, to be admired, to be respected for their religiosity. Even today in Israel, you go to a five-star hotel, right there on the door facing, there'll be a little box. That's called a mezuzah. And it has a little bit of the Torah inside of it, because these laws you'll put on the door facing of your homes. And so you'll see them in hotels as well. Deuteronomy 6:20, in the middle of 170, in the future when your son asks you, which tells us that spiritual conversations in the home are the norm, not the unusual. But when your son asks you, what's the meaning of all these rules and regulations, these commandments and so forth? And he goes on, I'll just summarize it. It's to remind us, we once were in bondage, but we were delivered by God. In other words, once I was lost in sin, but now I've seen the light and I've come to know Christ. That would be my personal application as a New Testament believer. For the Old Testament, we were in bondage. God delivered us. He promised us the land, that we would live in the land that He promised to our father Abraham. And He promised that we would be blessed in that land if we were obedient to Him. And that's what that whole Deuteronomy 6:20 is. Therefore, there's a command. Chapter 7, drive out the nations that are already there. They're under divine discipline. God is using the Israelites to judge the Canaanites. And when you come to that land, destroy them completely. No treaties, no mercy, no intermarriage. Why? Because if you don't, you're not going to elevate them. They're going to drag you down. And you'll become like them. They will not become like you. So consequently, you have a divine responsibility to be the hands of God in judging a Canaanite nation. Next page, what should they do? Top of page 171, break down their altars, their places of false worship. Verse 6, why do you do this? Because you're a people holy to God. God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the earth to be His treasured possession. Or in Exodus 19, you're a treasured possession, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. In other words, you stand out from all of the other nations, and it would be an obligation of the Israelites to be a light to the Gentile world. They, as a nation, would mediate the blessings of God to all the other nations. But they didn't do that. They failed in that. Why would God do such a thing for Israel? Why would He drive out the inhabitants? Why would He give Israel this land? You read through it, it's because He loves them. And He made a promise, and He's going to keep His promise. Why does God do these things for us? Because He loves us, and He's made promises within the Scripture, and so consequently His goodness and His love is brought out in Deuteronomy 7:7-10. Let's turn the page. Look in the middle of page 172, but here we have a caution. In the midst of all this, this new generation, in the midst of all this, Moses is preaching away. I mean, I just heard the tribe of Issachar say amen. Do not forget the Lord. Deuteronomy 8 is a chapter of caution to the nation. There was always the fear that in time people would forget what God had done. Everybody, look at me. Is that not the fear today? That if you've known Jesus for 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, I've known Him for 46 years and counting. And the danger always is to take for granted what God has done and to forget the way that I was and what God's been doing in those years. So it's a caution. And there are two cautions here to keep them from a spirit of independence from God. There are two cautions. We've seen these before, but here they are in dramatic relief. Number one, be careful. Be careful. Notice the the highlighted words, the bold words in Deuteronomy 8:1. Be careful to follow every command. Look down to Deuteronomy 8:10-11. Verse 11, be careful that you don't forget the Lord. Look at the next page. Not only be careful, but remember. When you're careful, then remember. The power of memory. Remember how God led you in the wilderness. Remember that He fed you with manna. Remember that He was teaching you that man does not live on bread alone, but every word that comes from the mouth of God. I have heard that somewhere. Oh yes, that's how Jesus replied in one of the three temptations of Matthew 4 and Luke 4, where He says, turn these stones into bread. You're hungry, Jesus. You've been out here fasting. You're hungry. And Jesus quoted Deuteronomy chapter 8. Know, Deuteronomy 8:5, that in your heart as a man disciplines his son, so the Lord will discipline you. Know that. Remember verse 18 of Deuteronomy 8. Remember the Lord your God. It's He who gives you the ability to produce wealth and enjoy prosperity and have this material blessings in this land that God is bringing to you. So don't forget God when you get all of these blessings. Danger. Prosperity can lead to forgetfulness. You see, when you have wealth and material blessings and you have possessions and so forth, your need for God is not on the front burner. And so there's this warning. Remember, don't forget, be careful that in the times of blessing in the land that you don't forget God and then become disobedient. There's a good word there in the box. I'll let you lead that or read that later. Turn the page, 174. Deuteronomy 9 is a heart check. Basically, God says, I chose you. To enter into relationship with you, Israel, not because of any good thing in you, but because of my faithfulness to what I promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all of the Israelites. So remember and never forget. In fact, he even makes a beneath that box, he even makes a reference in Deuteronomy 9:7 to the golden calf incident where they quickly forgot. The God who brought them out of Egypt. It wasn't that golden calf. It was the God who is not to be represented by any kind of idol or image. So what did Moses do in that golden calf thing? He lay prostrate before the Lord. He prayed, please don't destroy them. Remember your promises to the patriarchs. And that moves us over to chapter 10 and 11. And here's the challenge. And I would call this, excuse me, I would call this the challenge of the Christian life. Look at it. Top of page 175. Fear, love, and obey. Fear the Lord. That means have reverential respect, sense of awe. I mean, who are we dealing with here? We're dealing with the Creator of the universe who has, in a sense, humbled Himself and incarnated in human flesh in order to provide a means whereby sinful, rebellious man can enter into right relationship with God. We fear God, reverentially respect God, have a sense of awe of God. We love God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And then thirdly, we express that love in what? Obedience. It's just real, real simple stuff. Fear, love, and obey. Well, I have some verses on fear the Lord, love the Lord, and obey the Lord. You'll see those on page 175. At the very bottom, they connect that with, you do that in order to enter into the land. And eight times in verses 8 through 12, land comes up. That promised land that was promised to Abraham. Let's turn the page. Look at beneath the passage in the middle of the page. There's a comment there. Obedience out of love for God would provide needed blessings while living in the land. Now, let's just back up and catch what's going on. Here's what Moses is preaching along. This is what he's saying. Listen, second generation. We're about to go into the land that was promised to our father Abraham. When we get into that land, we're going to be blessed unbelievable. Let's not forget the Lord when we get in that land. And by the way, the blessings will flow as long as we're obedient to what God commands us. Okay? Pretty simple. Pretty simple stuff. So obedience is the obedience brings blessing. So what do you think disobedience will bring? Discipline or cursing. So let's turn to the next page, 177. I want you to see the chart that is on page 177, because beginning with chapter 12 through 26, that 15 chapters is what is known as the Deuteronomic Code. And one of my professors, Dr. Eugene Merrill, has done a magnificent job in his commentary on the book of Deuteronomy. And I can recall, I had him as a professor, I had him for history of Israel. And he has captured in this chart the Ten Commandments of Deuteronomy 5 and how those each of those Ten Commandments are expanded in principle form in the middle column. In other words, the command in Deuteronomy 5 is, you'll have no other gods before me. In chapter 12, 1 to 31, we expand that through the Deuteronomic Code, we expand that idea. The description in the right-hand column is a one-word synopsis of what that command is driving at. For example, you'll have no other gods before me. That's driving at fidelity to God. Fidelity to Him and to Him alone. Now what's going to happen is we've got a loose collection of Deuteronomic Code laws all associated with one of the Ten Commandments. And that's the next several pages. And we are not going to be going in detail on these. I just want you to see the chart and understand, and we'll just hit a few high points, understand the Deuteronomic Code is really taking the Ten Commandments and putting under that umbrella of each command several other related ideas or related regulations. So let's turn the page, give you an idea of what we're talking about. We're talking about law and life in Canaan. When we get into the land, and we got to obey the statutes and so forth. Well, here's the first one. Pertaining to the first commandment, fidelity, stated, you'll have no other gods before me. And then Deuteronomy 12 expands it. So he'll say, you're not to worship the Lord your God in this way. You're to seek the place the Lord will choose. In other words, when you go into the land, you don't start creating altars and places to worship like the other nations would. Your fidelity to God is you worship Him wherever He tells you to worship and however He tells you to worship later when you get into the land. What that's going to lead to is Jerusalem and a particular place called Mount Moriah, where there will be a temple mount, and King David will want to build the temple, but Solomon will actually be the one who will build the first temple. All of this is foreshadowing a bit of what is going to happen. Pertaining to the second command, it's the bottom of 178. That's the command, you'll not create an image or an idol. No idols, in other words. An idol is speaking of worship or false worship. So on the next page, when we expand it, we talk about false prophets who are related to the worship of God. And so there's some instructions, Deuteronomy 13, on false prophets. Also, point B at the bottom of 179, close relatives or friends who are not our friends. If such a one attempts to lure Israel away to the false worship of other gods, be they family or friend, that one is to be stoned. Why? We're under the umbrella of the second commandment of no idols and proper worship and so forth. So you see how this is all working. The third commandment, the name of God, you don't misuse the name of God or take it in vain. That's stated at the top of page 180. The expanded portion of this is that God is to be treated special. The big deal about not taking the Lord's name in vain is not that the word God and the word damn used in close proximity is some kind of earth-shattering bringing together of bad words. What it is it's me taking God lightly, that I can call upon God and have Him damned to eternal damnation or condemnation, something, a thing or a person or whatever. We hear it as a cuss word. You know, God, damn this thing. But what we are saying in literality, we're taking God lightly and saying, I want you to condemn to eternal damnation something. And that's using God's name lightly. You don't toss His name around lightly. And so consequently, you'll see in the expanded comments, that this command is learning how to treat God as special, not someone that we take lightly. How does our model prayer begin? Jesus gave it to us. Our Father in heaven, hallowed, holy, special is Your name. A holy God is to be approached carefully and circumspectly. And so there are certain behaviors, diet instructions, all of these things are given under the umbrella of how we don't take God lightly. Fourth commandment, the Sabbath. We keep it holy, as God told us to keep it holy. We were slaves in Egypt, but He delivered us, so we keep a Sabbath day as an example of that. This speaks, when it's expanded in Deuteronomy, we talk about the holy rhythm of the Sabbath. Not top of page 181, in that holy rhythm of observing the Sabbath, there were things they were to do with their tithes. There were things about provisions for canceling debts every 7 years. Freeing bondservants is in the middle of the page. Worship through dedication, point D, is at the bottom of the page. Worship through the Passover at the bottom, turn the page. Worship through the Feast of Weeks. Worship through the Feast of Tabernacles. Deuteronomic code instructions given under that umbrella that we see pertaining to the fourth commandment, which is the keeping of the Sabbath. What about the top of page 182? Pertaining to the fifth commandment. The fifth commandment is honor your father and mother. What's the bottom line thread that runs through honoring father and mother? It's an authority issue. In other words, parents are the authority over children, and even as those children grow older, there is a respect and a dignity that the parents continue to have. And so, Deuteronomy, the statement of the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother. When we expand that, we expand it on the basis of the principle of authority. So we have judges who have authority over us. That's point A on 182. We have the authority of God at the bottom of 182 all the way over to the top of 182. We have the authority of the law courts, point C. We have the authority of the king. In fact, the king, they don't have a king yet, but someday they will have a king. Kings were prophesied even as far back in Genesis chapter 49, and that a king would come forth from the tribe of Judah. But when they would have their first king, there are regulations of how they choose the king. Saul will be the first king, and then David, and then Solomon. Solomon in particular will almost break all of these regulations for the authority of the king. We have point E, the authority of the priests and Levites at the bottom, authority over false worship, all the way over to page 184. We're moving fast, aren't we? But we've got the flavor, and you can go back and actually pick up on this and read it for yourselves. But we have the authority of the prophet in chapter 18. But here we've got to stop for a moment. This is one of the most dramatic prophecies in all of the Scripture. Listen to Deuteronomy 18, verse 18. One day, prophetically, I will raise up for them a prophet like you, Moses. This is God speaking. I'll raise up a prophet like you, Moses, from among their fellow Israelites. I'll put my words in his mouth. He'll tell everything I commanded him, and so forth. Who do you suppose the prophet is that is being spoken of here? It's Jesus. It's the Messiah. And so here is a messianic prophecy that there would arise one day a prophet who would speak the words of God, a prophet who would be far greater than Moses. By the way, that's the writer of Hebrews' argument that Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, is superior to the prophets. He's superior to angels. He's superior to Moses. He's superior to Joshua, the conqueror of the promised land. Superior to Aaron and the Aaronic priesthood and the whole Levitical system. Jesus is the ultimate superior high priest. And that's the whole argument. We saw it back in the book of Leviticus. I'll raise up a prophet. He also talks about anybody who would presume to be a prophet. And some basic questions. How do we know a true prophet? Only if what they prophesy comes to pass exactly as prophesied. And that's the answer. Top of the next page, 185, the sixth commandment, murder. It's real simple. You shall not murder. Expanded. What about manslaughter? What about if you unintentionally kill somebody? That's chapter 19. Turn the page. What about witnesses? There's a strange little deal they talk about. Don't you move the boundaries of land. And you'd say, how does that deal with murder? Well, you move the boundaries of somebody, they may get angry. Jesus later says anger leads to murder. And so that's what the loose affiliation is falling under that umbrella. So be careful about that. Rules of warfare as opposed to murder. Is there just war and those kinds of things? Unsolved murders. You've got a little bit of a study about that. Next page, marrying a captive woman, the right of the firstborn, rebellious son, and miscellaneous laws. They're all loosely related and falling under this whole statement of number six, murder. All right. Number seven, adultery. You shall not commit adultery. Notice the comments at the bottom of 187. The sanctity and purpose of marital life or relationship was to be protected. Sexual offenses were not to be tolerated in ancient Israel. So you shall not commit murder. Move over to the next one, 188. Adultery. Number eight, theft. You shall not steal. Notice how that's expanded. Okay, we have a banker present. With respect to charging interest, usury was there was a command against exorbitant interest rates in Israel. Why? That was considered to be an act of stealing. With respect to vows, don't you steal, if you make a vow to God, don't you steal that vow away and not perform it. With respect to gleaning and harvesting your neighbor's fields, portions of a field were supposed to be left for the poor, and they're not stealing from you. That's a provision for the poor to be able to eat and have food. Next page, with respect to marital duties and rights, don't steal from your spouse, in a sense. Moses then regulates the practice of divorce and the certificate of divorce. And I even have a New Testament insight that I'll let you read later. The ninth commandment, false witness. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. It's all expanded for you on page 190. Jump to page 191. Pertaining to the tenth commandment, coveting, desiring something that belongs to someone else. You will not covet your neighbor's wife, and so forth. It's expanded. There are even some instructions on levirate marriage and some other unrelated laws that are just kind of lumped in on the 10th one. All of that is called the Deuteronomic Code. What's the key idea? It's built upon the Ten Commandments. As Moses preaches the Ten Commandments and expands laws that they must follow when they enter into the land. It's incumbent upon them, because if they don't follow these laws, they will be cursed or disciplined. If they do follow these laws, God says, I'll bless you magnificently. Now, in the third and fourth address, we'll not be covering, but I just want to, again, hit some high points on these. The third address begins on page 192, and this is our covenant ceremony that will be done in Moab. From here on, these are future responsibilities. When you enter into the land, here's what I want you to do. You'll go to Mount Ebal, and you're going to have a covenant renewal ceremony at Mount Ebal. A part of that, on the top of page 193, are specific cursings, 12 specific cursings. When you enter into the land and you're having your covenant renewal and everybody's saying, yes, we will obey the Lord, well, 12 curses come out. But here's the interesting thing. 8 of these 12 curses relate to the Ten Commandments. So we have that same theme being drawn along the book of Deuteronomy. Middle of the page, we get a further elaboration on covenant loyalty. And this is huge in the book of Deuteronomy. Notice blessings and curses. Blessings are due to what? Obedience. If you fully obey, follow His commandments, I'll set you high above all the nations. All these blessings will come upon you. Blessings are conditioned on obedience. You'll have material, political, spiritual, all kinds of blessings will come. However, if you don't obey the Lord, what do you get? Curses due to disobedience. Or you'll be disciplined by the Lord, top of page 194. Those are the kinds of disciplines. You'll have curses instead of blessings, curses as forms of punishment. You'll be defeated before your enemies. And here's the one you circled, number 4. You'll be deported and taken to a land far away. Think Assyrian captivity and Babylonian captivity. Why did that occur? Because they were not obedient to God, and they did not embrace His commandments. They did not obey His commandments. Therefore, they were judged with that discipline. All of this is summarized a bit on the top of the next page in the box, but we want to look beneath that box to the fourth and final address of the future responsibilities, part 2, if you will. In this section, we're seeing what some people call the Palestinian covenant coming to the forefront. When God spoke to Abraham and said, I will give you land, I'll give you descendants, and I will give you a blessing, and you'll be a blessing to all the nations. In that land aspect is amplified in Deuteronomy chapter 30. And that's on page 197, middle of the page. And that basically says that Palestinian covenant, the land of Palestine or the land of Canaan, will be yours, and you will live in that land. But you need to understand that if you ever disobey God and you're taken away from your land, you must repent and confess your sin, and then God will allow you to return. Hear this, because this is a very important New Testament principle. Restoration is always preceded by repentance and confession. If I have a ruptured fellowship with God because of my sin, I cannot be restored into right fellowship with God apart from my confession and repentance. It's a biblical principle rooted in the Old Testament. It comes over in the New Testament as well. So, we have the Palestinian covenant and various aspects of it on page 198, also on page 199. If you go to page 200, the point 3 in the middle of the page, the death of Moses, it's described for us there in a little bit of detail. By the way, I don't think Moses wrote this. I think we have an inspired person coming along and giving us this and adding it to this inspired collection. Quickly, I want to give you 6 takeaways from Deuteronomy. Number 1, trust and obey. That's a foundational principle for living a life of faith. Whether you're a member of the nation of Israel or whether you're walking with Jesus in the New Testament, trust and obey is a foundational principle. Why can't I learn that? Number 2, God's faithfulness of the past assures us of God's faithfulness of the present. God's faithfulness of the past assures us of God's faithfulness of the present. You're in a stretching, trying, difficult time. Remember God's faithfulness. And the faithfulness of yesterday is the faithfulness of today and will be the faithfulness of tomorrow. Number 3, would you say the Ten Commandments were a major theme ran all the way through the Deuteronomic Code, 15 chapters. The Ten Commandments is a major piece of the law. Listen to this. The Ten Commandments. We do not break the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments break us. That's how we were intended to live. That's a part of the design. We as human beings cannot live worshiping idols. It destroys our humanity. We cannot live worshiping other gods. There's only one God. We were created and designed. It's hardwired within our very essence. We cannot do this. We are not created to murder. When we do so, we diminish our humanity. And so the Ten Commandments don't... We don't break the Ten Commandments. Ultimately, they break us and harden us and render us less than what we were created to be. Next, the laws of God boil down to a simple challenge and two obligations. Love God and love our fellow man. Fifth, next to last, fifth, two key words for Christian living. They were true for Israel, they're true for us. Be careful and remember. Be careful and remember. And finally, obedience leads to blessing. Disobedience leads to discipline. Hebrews 12 tells us that God will discipline us as children, as His sons and daughters. And that discipline is difficult for a moment, but it will yield the fruit of holiness and righteousness. And if God loves us, He's not going to let us just run wild. He's going to bring His disciplining hand upon us so that we can be restored to Him through repentance and confession. I conclude with this. Know therefore this day, and consider it in thine heart, that the Lord, He is God, in heaven above and on the earth beneath. There is none else. God bless you. Thank you for coming. Yeah.